Welcome to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Brought to you by EV Mobility, here to keep you moving. For daily life, travel, or just having fun, visit goevmobility.com. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders impacting our community. Text your comments or questions directly to the studio at 540-371-5756 or comment on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
We are going to talk the election this morning, an election recap, and we do this every year, Dr. Farnsworth, because every year there's an election in Virginia. Dr. Stephen Farnsworth here, the professor of political science and international affairs and director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies at the University of Mary Washington. Thanks for getting up and coming in this morning.
Glad to be here.
Here we go again. We're going to start off nationally and kind of look at the national picture, and then we'll funnel it down and talk local politics. Surprised nationally because most people were talking about a red wave and Republicans controlling both House and Senate in some form, and didn't turn out that way.
Well, I really do think that the Republicans sort of walked away from what should have been a normal year for congressional midterms. Normally, these congressional midterms are painful for the president in power. Normally, the president's party loses, say, 24 seats in the House, 3 or 4 in the Senate, and oftentimes control of one or both chambers. And if we were having this conversation in May or June, I would have said that's basically where things are going.
Yeah.
Presidents are unpopular. And in the case of Biden, you know, there were very significant issues with respect to the economy, economic anxiety, inflation, all of those kinds of things are all going to be dropped at Biden's door, whether he's responsible or not. Presidents get more credit, they get more blame, and so on. So, but, you know, two things happened that made this an even election. You know, there'll be a few gains. Democrats will pick up one more seat in the Senate probably. The Republicans will probably end up with the control of the House based on where things stand this morning. But really, the Democrats had something to talk about other than the economy, which is what they needed more than anything. They had two things they could talk about. One, they could talk about Donald Trump, who inserted himself not only in the choice of the Republican candidates,
right,
but also in the campaigns throughout the fall. Two, the Supreme Court and abortion. That really energized a lot of people, as we saw early on from the reaction in Kansas when they had a referendum. And you look at how that issue sort of really motivated younger voters, especially, and women, to get out and participate. Normally, that doesn't happen as much in the midterm elections. It's much generally an older audience that participates in the midterms. And so the Democrats were very fortunate they could change the subject. Yeah. And the Republican Supreme Court helped with that, with this decision to overturn Roe versus Wade. And then Donald Trump helped with that as well.
I should have listened. A friend of mine from Kansas, when that vote took place, that was from Kansas, told me that for him that was really something significant, and said to me that that vote was not expected. And looking back, I should have zeroed in on that a little bit more.
Well, the reality is that you give people a reason to vote, you shouldn't be surprised when they do. And so when you make a big change like that, abortion had been legal nationwide in this country for almost 50 years, and all of a sudden states have their own options deciding what to do next. The risk that people saw to the choices that they wanted to make, that really encourages them to turn out. And that is a significant challenge for the Republican Party going forward. If you are going to run culturally conservative candidates, particularly those without experience, you're going to face a world of hurt in states where there is competition. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, a pro-life candidate in Alabama is not going to suffer for that. But it hurts in Pennsylvania. It hurts in Michigan. It hurts in a lot of the key swing states that we're talking about, some of them still up in the air, right? You know, you have a governor's race in Arizona that's still open. You have some other issues with respect to the runoff in Georgia. These are issues that you have to remember to be where the voters are. And when you create an environment that gets people angry, you've got a problem.
Do political parties learn from things like this? Or are you, will the Republican Party analyze this and learn anything?
Well, it's important to realize that parties don't really control much anymore. I mean, if you asked the Republican Party in 2015, do you want Donald Trump as a nominee, they would have said certainly not. He's too mercurial.
Yeah.
He's too erratic. It's not clear that he really is a Republican. He'd given money to Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton back in the day.
Yeah.
The Republican Party would say, what would we get with this guy? We have no idea. Okay. So if the Republican Party elites had had a say, it wouldn't have been Donald Trump. And even the Republican primary voters, they were going in very different directions in 2016. You had Ted Cruz, you had Marco Rubio, you had John Kasich, you had three people who were splitting the anti-Trump vote. And so the anti-Trump vote never really got organized and collectivized in a way that really meant that Trump wouldn't be the nominee. So Trump goes into these states. You know, he does okay. He gets 35-40%. Sometimes that's enough to finish first. And then he lives to fight another day. And then he becomes a Republican nominee, in large part because the majority of the party at the time, the elites and the voters, didn't want him, but they couldn't agree on anybody else. If the party bosses had had their say, they would have put Cruz and Rubio and Kasich into a room and said, one of you comes out of this room as the alternative, not three alternatives. But in the end, you know, Donald Trump has now become the sort of marquee standard by which Republicans are judged in primaries. In most cases, if you're not a fan of Donald Trump and you're a Republican, you're not likely to be renominated. And so that reality is not what the party leadership wanted. It's what comes as effect of how fluid this process is and how little control the top has. Donald Trump was very, very good at connecting with the anger and the grievance that a lot of his base voters were feeling about how America was changing. And that created an environment where he was really pretty unstoppable within the Republican Party. The problem is that once you get out of the Republican Party, you're in a place like Pennsylvania, say, that the Trump message doesn't resonate as widely in a general election as it does in a primary. And that's where the party, I think, suffers. If you look at all those first-time candidates, you know, Bull Duck in New Hampshire, Dr. Oz in Pennsylvania, Herschel Walker in Georgia, these are people who really could have stood to have run for Congress or something and learned how to do this campaigning before they ran for the Senate. And so it seems to me that Trump sort of hobbled the Republicans with a set of not ready for primetime candidates, particularly in Senate races around the country. And that created an environment coupled with the Supreme Court decision where the Democrats could do pretty well in terms of the Senate, at least.
We'll talk Trump again before we get out of here, probably a few more times. Dr. Stephen Farnsworth here from University of Mary Washington. Quick break. We'll be back on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Brought to you by EV Mobility. Here to keep you moving. For daily life, travel, or just having fun, visit goevmobility.com. You can weigh in about today's Town Talk topic on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, your host, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth here, the professor of political science and international affairs and the director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies at the University of Mary Washington, as we talk about the election. So locally, fascinating race, the 7th District. Boy, that whole district changed, and I think a lot of people thought that because Congresswoman Spanberger was going to lose the Richmond suburbs, that might be a hindrance to her. She did very well in Prince William, and that both Prince William in the city and a narrow election, but she won.
Yeah, I think that what you saw here was a dynamic that sort of replayed the national conversation we just had a moment ago. You had a candidate who was working hard, a candidate who had an opportunity to change the subject from the unfavorable economic conditions that would hurt a Democratic candidate in this cycle. I think the Vega campaign had really suffered as a consequence of that statement about rape and pregnancy. And that became kind of the weaponized theme that Spanberger used in her mailers, in her attack ads, that really put, I think, Vega on the defensive in this election. Because there's an important thing to remember about Republican voters in the suburbs compared to Republican voters in more rural areas. And that is that the culturally conservative message tends to work better in rural areas. When you're thinking about the Republicans in the suburban areas, they tend to be much more Republicans who are connected to issues of low taxes, libertarian kind of Republicanism, rather than Christian warriors, as you would see more common in rural areas.
Right.
And so abortion is exactly the wrong issue to have front and center on an agenda if you're a Republican candidate, where you need a lot of suburban votes, because this new 7th district is basically an I-95 district. It's Prince William, it's Stafford and Spotsy, it's Fredericksburg. And when you're thinking about all those voters who live along Interstate 95, you're talking about an electorate that is not nearly as rural-dominated as the old 7th district, which was basically from western Spotsy down to Chesterfield and all the rural areas in between.
Right. She, Vega campaigned a lot in Stafford and put a lot of effort into Stafford. And the Stafford vote to me was so interesting on election night. You looked at Prince William and weren't too surprised. Although she's a supervisor in Prince William, and you thought she might do better than she did. But for Stafford to be, it was basically Vega won Stafford by like 50-49. That was the surprise, and it shows. And a few Democrats have now won seats on the Stafford Board of Supervisors. Stafford's changing.
Yeah, I think that this is a painful reality that Republicans have to appreciate. They have to be more competitive in the suburbs. The reality is that Vega, who her district in Prince William is further west. Her district wasn't the area that's included in the 7th.
Right.
So she wasn't as well known in that part of Prince William, perhaps. But the reality is that you simply have to figure out a way, if you're a Republican candidate, to tailor your message in a way that is more acceptable, more appealing to Republicans in the suburbs. If you think about a year earlier when we had the governor's race, you know, you can see that Glenn Youngkin, I think, very effectively worked this campaign on the area of parental control, local authority mm-hmm. over schools. And that was something that I think really connected with a lot of Republicans who had been pretty discouraged by the last several elections. I mean, if the Republican Party is going to be represented by people like Corey Stewart or other cultural conservatives focusing on issues of immigration or anti-abortion politics, that's going to get you the rural areas, but it's a tougher slog in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can also look, although we're talking about Stafford at the moment, you can also look at the numbers in Spotsy, and the Republicans didn't win Spotsy by as much as they have in the
right.
past.
Right, yeah.
You know, the challenge, I think, for the Republican Party is to look at the Virginia as it is today. You know, I think that sometimes the Republicans are still thinking about the glory days of the 1990s mm-hmm. when you had George Allen and Jim Gilmore and Republican majorities in the legislature, and thinking that that's the way to continue to run. And it just isn't. I will say, though, that the rural situation hasn't changed at all. I was looking at the numbers in Orange and in King George. And so for more rural areas of the district, or less districts, counties further from I-95, the Republican share is just about where it was 8 years ago. I mean, there hasn't been much of a change there at all. The real erosion of Republican support in this area especially is in those parts of Stafford and Spotsylvania, particularly those closest to the commuter corridor of I-95 and the VRE.
That's interesting, and I would think if I'm a Republican in Spotsylvania running for office, I'm looking at what's happening in Stafford and starting to take note, because there's a lot of building going on in Spotsylvania, and people no question are moving down.
Well, I mean, there really are two stages of suburbanization. I mean, I've written about this, and I know we've talked about it before, because the first set of people who move into a rural area when the suburbs are getting together are people who are really sort of interested in having big properties. They want to be in a more conservative place. Mm-hmm. They want a community that feels right to them. That's the first wave of suburbanization. The second wave of suburbanization, and this is what we're going through now, particularly in our area, is this idea you just need a place you can afford. You know, yeah. And you're not coming here for ideological reasons or political reasons or anything like that. You don't want to. It's not like you want to be in a more Republican place than Fairfax or than Prince William. It's more that I can't afford Fairfax or Prince William, and so now I need a place. You know, you want a little backyard for your kids, say, or you want to be able to have a mortgage that you can afford that isn't going to break the bank, and then you're going to get yourself maybe a townhouse or a smaller place further from D.C. And so you're in Stafford, or you're in Spotsy, or you're in Fredericksburg. And then you're here in the second wave of suburbanization for a very different reason. It's much more economic than it was cultural. And that creates a very different vision of where the Republican Party is. I mean, you know, for people like us who've been around here 20 years, it's like every time we turn around, there's another development. It's like, this didn't used to be here.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, all of those apartments are full of people.
Uh-huh.
And those apartments are full of people who are not necessarily going to think about the Republican Party the way that the Republicans presented themselves 20, 25 years ago. And that's a challenge that that candidates are going to face. I mean, it's a challenge for Democrats, too, right? I mean, nobody's really an incumbent around here because there's so many new voters.
Right.
Even if the district lines don't change much, the people in the district may change a lot. And so, you know, even 10 years ago, we would talk about this with respect to, like, Ed Hauch was never really an incumbent. Bryce Reeves was never really an incumbent because of all the new people in the district.
Yeah. And I hear that from local candidates as well. For boards of supervisors or some of these local offices, that they go out and they're amazed at how many people have never heard of them, and they've been in office 15, 20 years. So that's an issue.
Yeah, it means campaigns have to work a lot harder. Candidates have to work a lot harder. One of the things that I always am amazed by people who run for office is how much stamina they have. You know, if you look at this from the outside and you think about just how much they have to do to connect with the voters and to raise the money and to do the public events, it's exhausting to even contemplate it, much less do it.
Bobby Orrick told me that when he first was elected, 25, 30 years ago, if he started soon enough, he could go through all of every subdivision in his House of Delegates district. He can't do that now, so that's one of the realities. The other thing that Dr. Farnsworth, I think, comes out of this race in the 7th district, Abigail Spanberger is a good candidate.
Well, absolutely. You know, she starts with an unfavorable environment, like we talked about. These economic issues, they affect people every day. We go by how many gas stations? You know, I live near the college. I come down here. I go buy a bunch of gas stations, and I say, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know? And so the reality is that you've got a really painful environment for people to, if you're a Democrat and there's a Democratic president, when the gas prices go up, everybody sees it. We're reminded of it over and over again all day. And then, of course, we go to the grocery store and we see the same thing.
Yep.
And so, you know, you have to figure out a way to sort of deal with that unfavorable environment. And what you saw, I think, with the Spanberger campaign was a very effective campaign. This was a campaign, and in part, I think she's in her first two runs for Congress in the old 7th district. Those were not favorable district lines for her. She really had to work very hard. Mm-hmm. And so what you saw with the Spanberger campaign was just this extraordinary hard work by her, by her campaign team. They're knocking on doors. They're raising a lot of money. They're putting out a lot of flyers and ads. I mean, there was a lot that is required in such a circumstance. But the Spanberger campaign, seems to me, didn't make any serious mistakes. And they worked really hard. And so they were able to overcome that. If you particularly look at Prince William, there was some hope on the Republican side that Vega would be able to bring a lot of Latino voters.
She had with the Youngkin campaign.
Right. And so that was the hope that the Vega campaign had, was that area of the northern edge of the district, that part of Prince William near I-95, which is in the 7th, that she'd be able to use, you know, her identity, and she has a compelling life story to tell, would have been enough to bring people over. But you didn't really see all that much of a dent in the Democratic vote share there in that part of Prince William. So it seems like increasingly people are just simply in these partisan camps, and if you're not on their side, they don't want to hear from you.
Mm-hmm. Well, and on a personal note, it was disappointing for me. You and I have done debates for however how many years. There was no debate in the 7th district this year, and Usually, the University of Mary Washington has hosted them for years, and that was disappointing that the candidates didn't debate.
Well, indeed it was. I tried very hard to, you know, negotiate with the campaigns to figure out a way that we could make a debate work. The debate at Mary Washington involves all the key players in town, including Ted Schubel and the Chamber of Commerce and the Freelance Star. We had all, you know, a whole League of Women Voters. We had a whole series of key players in town that were trying to make this happen. And routinely, they do happen. You know, back when Rob Whitman was the member of Congress from this district, he came every time.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had all kinds of other candidates. You know, other Republicans were willing to come. Bryce Reeves came. You know, you had you had a whole series of Republican candidates. You know, we had Stewart, we had Durant, we had Mark Cole, and so it was really sort of a local tradition.
Yeah.
The Spanberger campaign said yes; they were willing to do it. The Vega campaign did not say yes. And then, of course, there was another effort to try to make a debate work in the Prince William in Manassas, in that area. And that also didn't happen. I want to say one thing about this before we move on, because, you know, I think it's really important for these debates to happen because we have so little of a conversation based on issues in politics today.
Yeah.
If you look at all the mailers and you look at all the campaign ads, you can see that basically it's about character assassination. The other side is so horrible, so awful, so corrupt or evil or whatever it might be. And so you basically end up with a really cynical electorate because people say, you know what? These people say that this side is evil. This side says the other side's evil. You know, they're probably both right. You know, and what you would get with a debate, even if it's only for one night, is a conversation that is very, very issue focused. And I think that's really important, not only for the candidates to get away from the nastiness that is the norm in campaigns, but also I think it's really important for the community, for the voters, you know, that we can say, okay, now I know what kind of a vision this candidate has for what they would do if they're elected. Because so much of the negativity from the ads doesn't tell us all that much about policy agendas.
Yeah, no, it the way your debates are always set up between the three, you, me, and then usually an editor or a reporter from the Freelance Star, we're all asking our own questions, and you get that perspective of things, and that's missing.
Right, and of course, the way that we have our debate structured, we also have audience questions. They
audience
fill
questions
out on
too, yeah.
index cards, and so if there's something we're missing, there's a chance for, you know, an audience question to be posed. And so we've had a system that we've been doing more or less the same way for 20 years, and we've pretty much had bipartisan agreement that this is a fine way to do this. And, you know, and even for the candidates who are more experienced or less experienced, because, you know, when you go up against Rob Whitman, who's been in government a long time, it's a challenge. They didn't have a problem with the format.
No, and it is good to see candidates on stage being pressed on things, because you learn things. You learn that they've got a grasp or they don't have a grasp.
Yeah, and I think that's really important for us all. It's you know, and my personal opinion is it's a really disrespecting decision on the part of the candidate to refuse to debate. It's not about me. I mean, I take the yes, I take the no, whatever the answer is from them. But I do think that the community suffers. Our conversation, our civic discourse is undermined, is poorer when we don't have a serious conversation about issues, not even for one night.
Yeah. Yep, it is unfortunate. From now on, though, when candidates come through here, I will ask them, "Will you commit to a Mary Washington debate?" It's a question worth asking.
Well, I really do think so. And when they're on your show and they're trying to be on their best behavior, maybe
right.
they'll be more likely to get a yes than than after they're the nominee or whatever.
But at least we can have it on. At least we can have it on record.
We can have it on record. Yeah.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth from UMW here. More coming up on News Talk 1230 WFVA. It is 8:32.
Okay, listen. We got to talk about something.
Talk done right. News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station.
ABC News, I'm Justin Finch.
Opinions, we've all got them, and we'd like to hear yours on Town Talk. Brought to you by EV Mobility, here to keep you moving for daily life, travel, or just having fun, visit goevmobility.com. Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Chubin.
Good stuff this morning with Dr. Stephen Farnsworth from the University of Mary Washington as we look back at what happened last week with the election. So let's talk. Donald Trump tomorrow, by all indications, is going to announce he's running for president. What do you think?
Well, that seems likely to me, too. Donald Trump has a few go-to moves, and one of the key ones that he uses is changing the subject when something is going on that he doesn't like. And if you listen to Republicans over the last several days, and you look at Republican polls, it's pretty clear that there is more of a sentiment that the party should move beyond Trump now than there was a week ago. Ron DeSantis, who won Florida, his reelection there as governor by 20 points, is now neck and neck in Republican polling about who the party wants in 2024. Trump wants to change the subject from this idea that Trump is to blame for poor candidates and other things that that he might be blamed for. So I think it's likely he will do that. I had the idea that he would probably wait until after he faced charges for a crime.
Try to
change the subject at that point. But maybe he's going to do it now. I thought that he is very likely to be charged with something, but by the end of the year or early next year, particularly if you think about what happened in Georgia when he's on the phone browbeating Georgia state election officials on tape, telling them to find him votes or that they're going to go to jail if they don't. That's election fraud. That's a crime. That by itself, irrespective of anything that happens on January 6th or whether you think there's incitement or not, they got the goods on Trump, I would say, with respect to that Georgia phone call.
Yeah.
And that's that's the time I would have thought that Trump would want to run for office and announce to change the subject against an indictment. But, you know, maybe he needs to move sooner than that because of the issues that are unfavorable at the moment. I think he would be, a potential Republican nominee. I think that a lot of Republicans still think positively about Trump. Polls show that there are a lot of Republicans who really think that he's one of the few people in politics who would look out for them. And so I do think that Trump is a credible choice for the Republicans in terms of what might happen. I think it also guarantees us that Biden will run on the Democratic side. The reason Biden ran in 2020 was that he didn't want Trump to be president. And if there's any risk at all that Trump is going to be a candidate in 2024, Biden, who has said he's planning to run again, will double down on that reality.
Were you surprised that Winston Sears, the lieutenant governor, came out last week and said, right after the election, that Trump was a liability and the party needed to move away from him?
Well, you know, that was a really interesting development. And of course, it triggered a response from Trump, not against Winston Sears, rather against Youngkin, who basically didn't disavow her comments, didn't endorse them either, but he basically, you know, in the Youngkin fashion, is trying not to make a commitment until he has to. And so it was really striking, I think, that she went out on a limb like that. You didn't hear Meares, the attorney general, say anything along those lines either. And so she's out there making that comment. Now, part of me suspects, or wonders at least, if maybe this was something that Youngkin wanted her to do as kind of a trial balloon to see if he could get away with taking a step further away from Trump to see what kind of reaction there was. But who knows? That's only speculation on my part. It just seems sort of out of the ordinary, if you will, for a Republican lieutenant governor to make a statement like that.
It's going to be interesting.
You don't have to.
No. No, there was no that was what was so surprising, and it was so quickly. It was day or two right after the election results were known. The other thing when you take a look at this is I wonder if Donald Trump's presence and especially him committing to running is going to put a lot of pressure on local candidates. There's a lot of hand wringing of I know with local candidates who are Republicans. Are they going to be asked to commit or you know, what do they do?
Yeah, well, that's just it. Donald Trump can be very useful to Republicans getting a nomination, but not always so useful in terms of winning an election.
And we've seen that.
Yeah, and we saw that here. The reality of the changing dynamics of Stafford, you know, this gives people pause. I mean, what you want as a candidate is not to give people any more reasons to vote against you. There are going to be people who vote against you because you're not of their party. Mm-hmm. There are going to be people who vote against you because they don't like you personally. Or there's some you know, who knows? It, particularly if, you know, you're a longtime person in the neighborhood, in the community, that they're old fights, with properties or whatever. And so you want to figure out how to minimize the number of people mad at you. And so if you end up having to weigh in on Trump, you know, that brings in another possibility that you're going to drive people away. And so I'm confident that most elected officials would rather not talk about Trump if they're Republicans, because even though it can help you get a nomination, it can hurt you in a general election. And so there are a lot of people who would agree with the lieutenant governor on this idea that Trump should stick to golf in Florida, but I don't know that they're willing to say it, because if you come out against Trump when Trump is still a viable political figure, you're taking a big risk. She took one, no doubt about it. We'll see whether or not that was wise in the weeks to come.
Well, before we get out of here this morning, I want to talk about 2020. Well, 2023. There's all kinds of elections in 2024, and we'll do that in just a second. But couple of things for people that don't know, the department that you oversee at the University of Mary Washington, you give students a lot of real life and real time experience in politics. It's a great program that I don't know that a lot of people, more people need to be aware of it.
Yeah, I run a research center at Mary Washington that does an annual survey of Virginia politics. And that creates a lot of opportunities for students to work with me on various research projects. You know, I do sometimes analytical columns for area media like the Times-Dispatch and mm-hmm. the Post, and students are co-authors on those projects. I have a book chapter that's about to be published on the pivotal role that Chuck Robb played in redefining the Democratic Party in Virginia. And I have one of my students who is a co-author there. She graduated. She's now in law school at William & Mary. And then others are working on other projects with me. It's a great opportunity, I think, for students to get a sense of political science by doing it, more than just reading about what others have done with it, as you might in a course. And so I really try to bring, you know, my student research assistants into these kinds of projects. And when we have debates, they're front and center. I let them mm-hmm. give me a question that I will ask on their behalf. They're timekeepers, or they evaluate the public questions. And so there's a central role for them in a lot of the things that we do in terms of getting people more interested in politics. We also, because I've been at Mary Washington 20-some years, I have a network of students who have gone on to work on the Hill or work in state government. And so there's a whole sort of alumni group of former Mary Washington students who can take a look out for the next generation of students. And so lots of opportunities for students to work for the governor, to work for the legislature, to work in Congress, or some cause that they may really care about in Washington, you know, as a lobbyist or so on. Mary Washington is a pretty public-spirited place. You know, one of the things that I've always liked about it is just how committed we are to training people to be engaged mm-hmm. citizens. One of the things that we're really proud of at Mary Washington is the fact that so many of our students go into public service, whether it's, you know, working on the Hill or working at the Peace Corps or NGO, non-government organization work, international development, and things like that. There are a lot of opportunities. And, you know, one of the great things that we always have going for us is where we are.
Geography plays a big part.
In this area, you know, just like real estate, location, location, location. And, you know, we have a commuter train that can take our students to D.C. They don't have to take a semester off to do a Washington internship. The traffic tends not to be as bad south of Fredericksburg compared to north of Fredericksburg. Mm-hmm. So the students can get on 95 and go down and work in the legislature when it's in session, or for the governor, whatever opportunities might appeal to them. And then, of course, there are always campaigns. You know, we have you know, a lot of students who are active in the congressional campaigns and the House of Delegate campaigns and things like that, because with an election every year in this area, there's an opportunity for a student every year.
And your polls, I will say, I mean, when you release, when you do polls, pay attention to the UMW polls, because you, I don't know how you do them, but you, you've got it down to where you're on to the pulse of generally the electorate.
Well, thank you for that. Our poll did show that there wasn't going to be a red wave, at least
right,
in Virginia.
It did.
And so we, you know, it turned out to be right. You know, I'm always a little worried. You know, a year ago, we were one of the first polls in Virginia to say that Youngkin was a really competitive candidate.
Yeah.
And nobody else was saying that. You know, I talk to my friends who are doing polls at other universities, and I say, I'm out on a limb here. Why aren't you seeing this too? And they say, well, we don't know. We maybe something's going on. But, you know, being out on a limb is not a comfortable place to be. But in the end, when Youngkin did win, we could at least say at Mary Washington, we told you so.
Yeah, no, when you see a Mary Washington poll, pay attention, because more often than not, and I can't think of any indication where I've seen things and it just hasn't worked out. They really are worth watching. Before we take a break, real quick, we still don't know some of these elections, especially in Arizona. Some of the vote counting, it's not like it used to be. You used to know, and there are reasons for that, but are we headed in a good place of where we have to wait so long, or is this what we're going to have?
Well, the first thing I want to say about this is that it is so good that we aren't having the kind of mayhem that we had after the 2020 election.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people who ran arguing that the 2020 election was stolen have actually been quite gracious about their own defeats. You know, they're not saying mm-hmm. that, you know, that it's the deep state that caused me to lose Pennsylvania or any of that kind of stuff. And so, you know, it turns out that the Trump narrative of a stolen election isn't being replicated by all these candidates all over the country.
Right.
There may still be a few exceptions, but by and large, people accept they win, they lose, whatever it is. And that's a good thing, because democracy doesn't work if the narrative is I win or the election was stolen. That's not the way democracy could ever survive. But the process is determined by state law in different places. And so if you've got in Arizona, you have a law that allows people to have an election day postmark, and then that mail mm-hmm. has to get from the post office into the election authority. So you can't count all the ballots on election day because they're not all there. They're not all there because state law has a postmark rule. I mean, we have a postmark rule here in Virginia, and we have an opportunity for ballots to come in late. We tend not to have as many coming in late as they do in Arizona. And that is a painful reality. There are also the occasional things in terms of you know, people abroad, you know, the people in the military and things like that. There's sometimes delays in ballots coming from overseas. And, you know, and I, for one, think that, you know, we have to keep the system open to people who have followed the rules through no fault of their own.
Right.
Because remember, we do not have an efficient postal service. You know, there were deliberate efforts in 2020 to undermine the rapid, effective delivery of mail, and mm-hmm. we're still struggling with that. And so if you have a state law that says postmark on election day, you can't count on that mail being delivered in the next couple of days. And so you have to leave it open. But I think that people need to increasingly recognize that counting takes time, even with automation. And you know, I think that by and large, the candidates have been willing to accept that. You know, you had a candidate for the Senate in Nevada, Adam Laxalt. He was ahead in polling in the early vote counting mm-hmm. up until the weekend. But he was telling his supporters, you know, the votes that are out are from the Las Vegas area, which is pretty Democratic, so this may not work out well. You know, he didn't declare victory ahead of time, although he might have been tempted to.
Yeah.
And he didn't argue that the election was stolen. He even gave his voters the heads up that this may not turn out to have a happy ending for us. And, you know, that is the kind of maturity
right.
that we want to see in our public officials. I wish we had more of that kind of recognition that this is how the process works. Because if you're going to tell people that something is being taken from them, you know, that the election is being stolen, that your vote doesn't count or whatever, you know, that Donald Trump said in the aftermath of 2020, you've really created an anger and a hostility to the political system that makes it very hard for anybody. Remember, Democrats win sometimes. Republicans win sometimes. You cannot run a political system saying that one party is always entitled to rule and it's stolen when they don't win the election. That's just simply the end of our democratic experiment, if people really believe that.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth here from UMW. We'll take a quick break and wrap this up on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
You're listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Brought to you by EV Mobility. Here to keep you moving. For daily life, travel, or just having fun, visit goevmobility.com. Got a question for today's guest? Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth is here from UMW. Before we get out of here, so it looks like the Republicans will have a couple seat majority, but if they don't, whoever has a couple seat majority in Congress, can anything get done?
The answer is, simple answer is no, not really, because you have to remember that if Kevin McCarthy ends up being Speaker, he's got to figure out a way to keep the liberal Republicans, the ones from New York and New Jersey, on board, at the same time keeping the more conservative Republicans on board. And he'll be hostage to both of these extreme elements of his caucus every time if you've only got three or four seats. Same thing would be true for Nancy Pelosi if she ends up Speaker again. And so anticipate an environment that is very much about gridlock. For Biden, though, you know, he'll focus on those things that don't require legislation. He'll figure out ways to do executive orders and administrative action that gives him the chance to do some of the things that can't get resolved. Given the likelihood of gridlock, expect an incredibly busy lame duck session. The Congress is back this week, and they're going to be doing all kinds of things that they want to do now because they're worried they won't be able to do anything come January. The debt ceiling, maybe structuring voting systems better, and then, of course, putting some long-term commitments in place regarding Ukraine funding.
Dr. Stephen Farnsworth, professor of political science and international affairs and the director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies at UMW. Dr. Farnsworth, let's get together in January and preview the General Assembly while we're at it.
Always another political conversation.
Thank you so much for coming in. We'll talk soon. Thanks.
Thanks, Ted.
That is it. Thank you for listening. We'll see you in the morning.
Thanks for listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Brought to you by EV Mobility. Here to keep you moving. For daily life, travel, or just having fun, visit goevmobility.com. The views expressed by the host and guests on this program are their own and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. Hear Town Talk anytime by subscribing to the Town Talk podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. The Glenn Beck program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.